We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Today, we are focusing on the science that could make or break the case against Brian Koberger, the role of DNA evidence and investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG. Koberger's defense team is fighting to exclude DNA evidence collected from the crime scene and the methods used to identify him, raising a lot of questions about the reliability, objectivity, and ethical implications of such advanced techniques. With DNA at the core of this case, stakes couldn't be higher for both sides. Joining us to break down the science and discuss how DNA is being used in criminal cases like this, Professor Dan Crane, an expert in forensic bioinformatics, molecular evolution, and the development of tools to evaluate forensic DNA profiling. I got through all of that without slipping up. Dan, with IGG becoming kind of the go-to tool in high-profile cases, how reliable is it, and where do investigators need to tread carefully to ensure objectivity and accuracy? Or is a lot of this just kind of, you know, woo, this could be scary, but it's really not?
Well, those are a lot of big words you just rattled off there. I'm impressed.
The innovation of the teleprompter allows me to use big words now.
So the question here is, what's up with IGG,
yeah,
right? That's just a pretty simple way, yep, to put it. And it's short for investigative genetic genealogy, mm-hmm, and it's a relatively new approach that law enforcement is using to identify suspects. I think perhaps the first time that I heard it being used in a case may have been as long as 4 or 5 years ago. So it's the new kid on the block in some sense with respect to forensic DNA testing. And at the essence, what's going on is that evidence samples are being used to generate a different kind of DNA profile than what is used in the context of conventional testing for a forensic type of evaluation. And unfortunately, there's some abbreviations that are in play. The type of information that's being generated for IgG is SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism information.
Okay.
And that's different from STR, short tandem repeats, which is what's used to match suspects and persons of interest in crime scene samples and has been for the past 25 or 30 years. And what happens is that single nucleotide polymorphism, the SNP information, gets used to search genealogy databases. And so people who are interested in family history, they do the cheek swab, they pay the $100, $150 and,
yep,
send it off to a place like Ancestry.com, for instance. What's being done is law enforcement is taking these crime scene samples in the Koberger case, for instance, generating a SNP DNA profile, and then asking databases, and it's unclear which databases the FBI used in the Koberger investigation, but the databases like what Ancestry.com has, mm-hmm, to see if they find somebody who looks like they're related, ideally to find a match to the person who was the source of the DNA at the crime scene. Mm-hmm. But if failing that, then maybe a father or a brother or a cousin. And that seems to be exactly how it is that Brian Koberger was identified as a suspect in these Idaho College murders. Law enforcement got DNA from the clasp of the sheath of a knife that was found at the crime scene, generated a SNP profile, searched an Ancestry kind of database, and found that some close relatives of Koberger looked like they could be a close relative of the source of the DNA at the crime scene. And then that law enforcement, so the FBI made a tip to the state law enforcement in Idaho and said, hey, you know, this guy might be somebody worth looking into. And then the traditional sort of gumshoe police work, was he in the area? Did he have a motive? All that sort of thing played out. And that in turn led to his arrest, the obtaining of additional DNA samples that they could do now the STR type of DNA testing on. And they're finding that he matches, apparently, at those genetic markers as well.
So it's, I mean, to me, when you've explained it like that, the way I've understood it now for a while, it doesn't seem like the science of this is really up for question in terms of, could you get it wrong? Like, you couldn't, really? I mean, like, I mean, maybe you could get it wrong in the sense of... I don't know. It's a raw, different match, and maybe it should match. I don't know, but could you get it wrong?
You know, there's wrong, and then there's really, really, really wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So there are degrees of wrong.
Yeah.
My understanding from what's in the public about the Koberger case is there doesn't seem to be a lot of question about how confident we should be in the match between.
Yeah.
Is STR profile and the crime scene DNA.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I'm not getting the impression that even the defense is saying it's not his DNA.
Yeah.
And what instead they're doing, so I might, if I were involved, I might quibble and I'll say, well, you know, we still have to worry about how much statistical weight to attach sure. to it. The way that he was identified raises some questions
yeah.
that need to be addressed.
And
but the bottom line is it's his DNA.
Sure.
And then the question is did they identify him as a suspect in a way that's consistent with the expectations of like the Fourth Amendment?
And yeah, okay. And I get, you know, the argument that's trying to be made, but there are no real clear cut rules on this right now. It's kind of the Wild West with this too a bit. So if it's not illegal, and it's able to help them hone in on a quadruple serial murderer, I know Koberger's side sees a problem with it because, well, he's going to die. But everybody else on the other side's like, well, without it, we wouldn't have figured out who this guy was.
Well, I don't know that we wouldn't have figured out who was, but that's certainly how they figured out who this guy was. And so, yeah, you must encounter this all the time in the real cases that you're looking at is, it's a difficult philosophical kind of issue because this is one of those cases perhaps where it's not that big a deal, but where the crime is so severe and so extreme.
Yeah.
But you know, what if this wasn't a quadruple
sure.
homicide? What if this was a jaywalking mm-hmm. kind of thing? Do we want law enforcement, you know, doing that kind of investigation? At some point, you have to draw the line.
And should it be at like kind of a degree system? Like, look, if this is could be possibly a capital crime or something of that nature, or rape, something of that, a certain. Crimes we put into this category. And if that's there, yeah, use it. If not, maybe it needs court approval or something. I don't know. Something of that nature.
It's kind of a slippery slope, though. If you say it's okay for quadruple homicides, but it's only okay for some rapes, and it's never okay for jaywalking, well, somebody's still going to have to decide about the rapes, which it's appropriate for. So it's a slippery slope, and you know the Fourth Amendment people, and I would imagine Koberger's attorneys are going to be saying.
Yeah.
Thing to the effect of, you know, this is akin, it flies in the face of some fundamental principles of Anglo-Saxon law that go back a long time. It was In the Old Testament, Jeremiah actually speaks fairly eloquently about, in the New Covenant, the sins of a father shall not be visited upon a son. And when you're talking about looking at these sorts of databases, you know, Koberger's DNA wasn't in the database. He didn't open himself up. And, you know, his relatives who are in that ancestry database may not have actually understood that by putting their DNA into the database that they were going to be making, you know, some of their relatives fall under a shadow of suspicion or be part of the suspect pool that's being searched. And so you know.
But that's it, though. They get into a suspect pool that's being searched.
Yeah.
And then eventually, because of the guarantee of the science, almost, if you can get a true match,
yeah,
you got your answer. So what's the problem with it? I mean, the odds of someone being the wrong person are virtually non-existent if you're going to truly match it all that way. I mean, I can see it if we're talking about something else, if it's more of, I don't know if there is, but if there's kind of a lesser way where it's like we can't quite get down to exactly, but we can get to this general area of people. Sure, I can see some arguments there. But if at the end of the day, you're getting somebody for a capital type crime, or I guess, I don't know. I mean, there's, like, again, I'm saying degrees of crime. I don't think anybody would waste their time on a jaywalker or something less. I think, it, you know, if it's really worth their time, they would really be looking at if it is a serious crime. So, I mean, I personally would be willing to really not care if it gets to someone who did commit that crime. Damned it be my relatives. I don't care if someone has done something horrible and they would need to pay for it. And if that's a way to find them, I don't see that being a bad way to find them.
I hear you. Mm-hmm. I understand. But I think I can distill your argument down to just a couple of words. And
okay.
It is the ends justifies the means.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, Koberger's attorneys are saying that the means by which he was identified are unfair, inappropriate, violating mm-hmm. principles. And you're saying, well, I don't know that I'm that concerned about that.
I don't know that it really violated any principles, honestly.
Well, how would you feel? But if the ends justifies the means, you know, let's substitute the means. How about torture? Right? How about if during the interrogation?
No, but we're not talking about that. I mean, if that was specifically, yes, no, I'm not okay for that. But I don't know that this truly violated anything. I don't see exactly where it does. I see where some people are questioning it. But that seems to be it. There's no, like, seemingly clear answer if it really was in violation of anything, if it was a resource that was available that you could use. And you're an investigator and there's a resource that exists that can lead you to something and there's no law preventing you from using it. Why would you not use it?
So that's where the constitutional lawyers
start
to get to work is there a law? And they point to the Fourth Amendment as a law that says you can't, it's an illegal search or it's an inappropriate search. And
what's inappropriate about it?
Well, I think a civil libertarian would argue that the people whose DNA is in that database, they put their DNA into that database for another purpose. There was a failure to get informed consent from them. They didn't consent to have their DNA being used to investigate crimes. Mm-hmm. They were asking, they were consenting to have to figure out who their grandmother was.
Sure. So, assuming that data and that DNA is used strictly within that circle of what they're trying to look for, but when it ends up coming out, I mean, you kind of have to have it all out there for the system to work. To have public access, I guess, is the issue, or, you know, you can get into it.
Well, there's two kinds of searches, though,
yeah.
Right? Most of the searches of those databases are by a person like you or me mm-hmm. who wants to know who our grandmother was or
yeah.
where our grandmother came from. That's the overwhelming majority. This kind of search is different.
Yeah.
It's not me saying, I'd like to know, and I'd like to have my DNA be part of that database going forward. It's law enforcement saying, we've got some DNA from a crime scene sample from somebody who almost certainly doesn't want their DNA in the database and almost certainly doesn't want to know who anybody to know who their grandmother is. And what makes it tricky is the grandmother whose DNA is in the database may not want their grandson to be identified. They just want to know, you know, where it is. And so again,
do they have the right to do that though?
Well, I think that question can be answered unequivocally if, when the grandmother put her DNA into the database, she knew that it might also be used for that purpose. But there's a pretty good chance that the grandmother who put her DNA into the database had no idea that it might be used as part of a law enforcement tool. And
sure.
So that's where the issue comes down to, is how important is that informed consent?
Sure. Well, I totally hear your arguments, and I understand both sides of this. And I agree kind of on both, because it is such a up in the air thing. It's a hard one to really, you know, set aside on, especially when you can see the benefits of it. But yes, I can also see the negatives if used improperly. But what about this? Because I'm sure this is something that I don't think a lot of people thought about in this, is not necessarily when you find out like your brother-in-law is the Golden State Killer. True story. I once sat on a couch with having this exact conversation with people that were telling me they were driving to California to go visit the Golden State Killer, their brother-in-law. Anyway, it's like, this is the weirdest dinner conversation I've ever had. They wanted to go spread the word. They wanted to save him is what they told me. I'm like, okay, good luck. I'm going to go get some more sausage or something. What about this, where you're in Ancestry or 23andMe or whatever, and you start looking and like really strong DNA matches to people who it's like, it says it's a first cousin, or even worse, like a, you know, brother, sister or something of that nature. And then everybody's looking at mom or dad of like, what's happened here? And there's a lot of that.
There are an awful lot of those stories. You know, I don't know, I've stopped keeping track of them. I used to keep a little file of all of the newspaper reports. I remember one headline was, I bought my parents DNA tests for Christmas, and I thought I was buying my parents DNA tests for Christmas, and I ended up buying them a divorce, right? I mean, that sort of thing happens an awful lot. And you know, maybe it's worth pointing out in that context, pretty much everybody in North America is under genetic surveillance in that sense. You only need a second cousin for these IgG searches to generate a hit.
Yeah.
Two second cousins, boy, now you can triangulate, you can really start to hone in, but one second cousin can get you pretty close. And the last time that I looked at those numbers, the estimates were something well north of 90% of people living in the United States have at least one second cousin in these databases. And so at least 90% of us could be identified in the same way that Koberger was identified.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So almost all of us are.
Yeah.
And North Americans are much more represented in these ancestry databases than any other population, right? So people in China don't do ancestry testing. People in North America do ancestry testing. And so to some extent, we're under more genetic surveillance than any other citizens of any other country are.
I want to ask about how some of this could go wrong, but first I want to go to that because I already lost my other thought. The way that this could go wrong, having your DNA information out there. I mean, I think recently some of it got hacked and the genetic information is out there, which I'm not really surprised by. I mean, I kind of feel like anything and everything can get hacked, and it's okay. How could that be used inappropriately? I mean, I guess the scary movie scenario in me would be like, I mean, could you, you know, engineer certain plagues or, you know, viruses or something to go after certain genetic makes of people? I don't know. I mean, you tell me, is that just kind of crazy or what?
It's not entirely crazy, but it would take an awful lot of work. It would take a really concerted effort. It would be like a government would need to fund it.
Okay, well.
Right. So it's not something that I could do in my basement.
I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about more like a government doing that.
Well, the government might.
Yeah.
But, you know, you ask how it could go wrong. Our government has some pretty clear thoughts exactly on how it could go wrong. People in our armed services are explicitly told to not participate in these types of ancestry tests because, as you've pointed out, it's not some have been hacked. It's my understanding all have been hacked. And foreign adversaries have those SNP DNA profiles.
Yep, I'm seeing you.
And what the federal government is concerned about for our military is, say you've got a, let's start at the top. You've got the, you have a general who you can get their DNA profile from. You put it into the database. You pick up their coffee cup. You get their profile. You search it. You find who they are, what their SNPs are, but more importantly, you find out who their relatives are. And part of this information that's in these databases is not just their SNP profile, it's also their name, their date of birth, often their address. And then that foreign adversary goes to the general and they say, hey, here's the thing. We know you've got like a circle of protection around you, but what about your daughter?
Yeah.
What about you know your grandchild, right? Are you going to be able to keep them safe? Because here's their name, here's their address, and what we'd like for you to do to help us make sure that your granddaughter is safe is give us these plans for this weapon system or whatever, right? And so you can imagine. And so we're starting out with a general, but you know, who's to say that a sergeant or a private might not have access to information?
No, I mean, it's kind of mafia like. But you could do it on such a more minute level than you ever could in the past, because you could find out that information. You know, it's not just like big people who you could probably figure out that information if you were a big government and have spies. But I mean, really have access to it now, and you know somebody's name, you could figure out quite a bit.
Yeah. So, personally, I see advantages to myself in having these SNP profiles generated and having them evaluated for medical purposes. I'd love to know if I have a particular risk for colon cancer. If I do, you know, maybe I'll ask my physician to really keep an eye on that. Or there may be maybe I won't eat as much red meat, whatever. There may be things that if I know that I have a risk, maybe I'll change things to address that risk. But I don't want to have foreign governments knowing what my SNP DNA profile is. I don't want law enforcement knowing what my... It's not that I'm trying to hide myself from crime or from being investigated for a crime. It's,
come on, Dan. We all know what's going on in your brain.
once they got you in your sights, in their sights, once there's a shadow of suspicion, it's your job to, you know, despite... innocent until proven guilty. Once law enforcement starts to think you may have something to hide, then it's an uphill fight for you to prove.
But doesn't this prove it more accurately than ever before? If for some reason you're in the sights of the government, for whatever reason, I don't know, but wouldn't this disprove or prove something right or wrong? Or does it just, I guess, I mean, you can go down the road too of like, well, if they want to plant it and say, look, this is yours no matter what, and here's the match because it's in our database. You're kind of out of luck because it'll be looked at as 100% correct.
I'm not that worried about law enforcement planting evidence.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be more than I am, but I'm not that worried about
whatever it may be. That. Evidence. Yeah.
What I'm worried about is my DNA being left behind somewhere, and then subsequently something bad happens there, and they pick up my DNA, and now I've got explaining to do, right? You know, I was at a McDonald's 3 days ago. There's a robbery there today. They do some swabs. They come away, and they find my DNA there. Now I have to start explaining, well, wait, I haven't been to that McDonald's for 3 days. Oh, mm-hmm. Do you have receipts? How can you have a receipt? I didn't go, right? I have a receipt maybe from 3 days ago. Mm-hmm. Once that shadow of suspicion falls on you, I'd just as soon not have to answer those questions. And if I'm not in the database, I don't have to worry about that.
Sure.
You know, and again, you know, now we kind of come full circle to Brian Koberger.
Yeah.
He didn't put his DNA in the database. And, you mm-hmm. know, it's like a relative of his put their DNA in the database. And
but it matches to him at a crime on the weapon.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, yes, it will cause more people to be questioned. I mean, again, if it's used super incorrectly, it could be a nightmare. But I think almost anything can be used that way. But if it's used in a just for catching criminals and things of that nature, and we, you know, there are some rules and regulations as to how this can be used and can't be used. I think that would make a huge difference. An opt-out system, would that be more appropriate than? But can you ever truly opt out? Once it's
well,
out there.
I think you said if there are rules. I don't think there are rules.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, if there would be rules, I think is kind of what I mean.
There would be. Yeah. But I don't think we're there right now. And again, I think Brian Koberger's attorneys are arguing a Fourth Amendment search and seizure sort of thing. There were no rules. Therefore, we need to interpret the Fourth Amendment in a way that would say. And if the way that they identified him as a suspect is found to be a violation of the Fourth Amendment, then almost everything else comes from that, right? Yeah. The Idaho law enforcement weren't looking at Brian Koberger.
Yeah.
The tip.
Even though, I mean, I can't imagine that happening, but the outrage, I mean, I think I'd rather be in prison if I were Brian Koberger than walking out the door after that ruling comes down of, oh, it's dismissed because of this. I think you'd have to go into hiding for quite a long time. Yeah. But I don't know. Stranger things have happened. But the outrage at that.
A lot of a judge.
Yeah. When you have that amount of things just pointing directly at him, and the DNA is there, but it would be thrown out over not having correct rules or not having rules on this, and the interpretation of those non-existent rules. That's, I don't know. That would be quite a feat, but yeah, it could happen.
Yeah. Well, and you know, again, attorneys, that's what they work for. So, you know,
exactly.
Part of the argument that those attorneys are making, I understand, is that a lot of this is also happening in a secret way, right? These hearings are closed. Even the relatives of the victims aren't allowed in the hearings to hear the arguments that and read the briefs that are going on. And maybe that then is feeding into some of what you were just suggesting. There seems to be such overwhelming evidence. Mm-hmm. We really don't know what the evidence is because all we know is what we're hearing, and we're not really hearing the whole story. And so maybe there's two things in play with the Koberger case. It's the Fourth Amendment thing, and it's also the secrecy with which the hearings are playing out.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly when you have a gag order in a case like this, the prosecution certainly has the advantage of controlling what comes in and out and what doesn't. And you're certainly going to want the public to be on your side, and they can pretty much market it that way. The thing is, though, if they're going to bring it to the table, if anything that has been released has been brought to the table, it's going to have to stand up. And the things that they're bringing up seem to be pretty black and white for the most part. There's not a lot of speculative stuff here, which I feel like you're going to have on the defense of he likes to look at the stars. I don't know. I mean, it's there's they certainly have some arguments. And if I were accused of this, I think I'd want Ann Koberger as my attorney, because she's doing pretty good for not really having a lot to work with. I mean, really looking at the case right now over Thursday and Friday here of this week, where they're having the hearings. I've seen headlines where the defense is basically arguing everything should be thrown out. Everything. I mean, and they have specific motions on it all. You know, they have the one where it's like, okay, the Fourth Amendment, but then it's also, what about this? And I get it. You got to see what you can do. What can you get eliminated? It's Jeopardy. But we'll see what happens here. This is a judge that doesn't seem to be taking a whole lot of crap.
Yeah. You know, but part of what's in play here is, for a case where the stakes are this high, the defense attorneys will leave no stone unturned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think it's even that big of a secret if you were to ask them. They would say part of the reason for doing all this litigation is to make the state, the government, reluctant to pursue the capital sentences.
Mm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, it let's make it as painful and as costly as possible to secure a conviction so that the government is less likely to ask for the death penalty going forward. Right. That's part of the game that's being played.
What I am wondering about this is if it's mainly trying to just save his life at this point. I'm wondering how backed in a corner Ann Taylor is, or feels she is, on this. And if, okay, like, is, I'm wondering, is this like kind of the last stand in hearings of, we're literally kind of throwing everything we have at this. And if you don't agree with any of it, and we're just kind of back in the same seat and we don't really have much of a defense, maybe we'll go to a plea agreement to spare his life and call it a day. I don't know.
Well, And layered in with that, yeah, sure, I would be shocked if that's not part of the defense team's hope, is to let, maybe we'll, you know, you throw 50 darts and you hope one of them hits the board, right?
Yeah.
And if none of them hit the board, layered in with that strategy is that each one of those is going to require a judge to make a ruling. Mm-hmm. And each one of those rulings then could be something that you could point to as part of an appeal that would cause a new trial. So in the event of being found guilty, you've got 50 chances to do it. And again, part of this is just to extend, you know, Koberger's life for as long as they can.
Yeah. I mean, if you can have some control of extending the time where someone could screw something up, might as well take it, because I mean, if you have nothing else to go on, go on that. I mean, how many trials do we see now that are being retried or get thrown out because of something so stupid? And it happens, and that may be the game they're playing.
Other things, it's certainly the game they're playing. That's you know, in a case like this where you're talking about death penalty, that's what death penalty attorneys will do.
I agree. Dan Crane, thank you for joining us. Always a pleasure to talk these cases and learn something.
All right. Well, deep philosophical discussions too.
Yes. That's good.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.